Instructors at Heartland Community College's new electric vehicle energy storage training program say it's nice to see auto training programs come back after high schools and colleges phased them out when they were younger. That story just ahead on WGLT's Sound Ideas. Good afternoon, I'm Charlie Schlanker. Suspensions don't help minority students, and an ISU scholar says schools are punishing kids who are already suffering. The Masonic Lodge in Normal has survived many decades when fraternal and social groups across the nation have not.
Normal Lodge has tapped into some of our younger members, tapped into the fraternities, other groups that might be interested.
The Masons in Normal are celebrating 150 years. Those stories and a Bloomington Normal News update just ahead. This is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas, on 89.1 FM and WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker and the Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity joined college officials and automaker Rivian for a first look at the new electric vehicle energy storage training program at Heartland Community College. The program will help prepare residents and companies doing business in central Illinois to keep pace with the fast-growing electric vehicle production sector. Tony Foose is an instructor for Rivian working at Heartland's facility on Martin Luther King Drive in Bloomington. Mike Devers is a Heartland instructor who talks with WGLT about the effort. Foose says autos are autos in some part, but the program is different from traditional work in important ways.
There are a lot of similarities in the core basics of the way the vehicle operates. The caveat with the electricity and the electric vehicles and the batteries add a little bit of a different platform to it, which actually allows more interaction with the vehicle and the consumer.
Enlarge on that, would you?
With everything being electronically controlled, the vehicle can take place of some of the safety issues that maybe a driver is, let's say if a driver is fatigued or distracted, a vehicle can take over stopping. It can help stability in turning in sharp turns or braking. You know, anything from even in case of an accident, it's got a lower center of gravity, which makes it safer in a rollover condition, which is for a pickup truck or an SUV, having a lower center of gravity makes it extremely safer on the road also.
I notice over there, there's an old Mitsubishi iMiEV as well. So it's not just the Rivian stuff that you're teaching. How many different platforms and are there crucial differences in those? Or is a lot of it the same?
Although we have a partnership with Rivian, we also want to allow the students to experience other manufacturers. The Mitsubishi you're referring to is a donation from State Farm, and it's an older technology. So there are different things that happen as the technology evolves, and a lot of that probably you've heard in the news is about, you know, battery cooling and that sort of thing. So there's different technologies employed as those vehicles have evolved. Plus, there are also different ways of performing the same function between manufacturers, so we want to have that exposure. Some manufacturers keep some of their computer systems proprietary, so by selecting different manufacturers, we have access to different components of the vehicle through the computer system and can do different things with the students.
Electric vehicles are still emerging, although they're soon to become possibly the biggest share of the auto industry. Over the next 20 years, how rapidly is it still developing? How fast is your rate of change?
Oh, that's what's wonderful about the CTE department here. There's always something new to learn, and we're always on the cutting edge, whether it be in the automotive section or any of the manufacturing sector. Yeah, I mean, it is as fast as they can improve anything from the engineering or the engineers at the auto companies and their parts suppliers. There's things going on now that we can't even imagine yet.
Like what?
Oh, let's see. Well, I think the biggest thing right now is the ability of the batteries to maintain their charge and how quick those can charge and how the life expectancy and everything. I think battery technology is the next big jump that we're going to see.
You're specifically with Rivian, cited at Rivian. How is the pipeline working toward Rivian workers?
We are working on multiple programs. As an instructor here, I'm supporting Heartland and the electric vehicle program they have. We will have future programs that'll have more of a streamlined pipeline, but you still have to make sure they have full education. So on average, if just to keep it generic, a student would probably be in school for about 2 years to be fully certified to be able to, as an entry-level technician into an electric vehicle dealership.
And hit the high points of what they'll learn in that time, would you?
You learn everything. So one of the programs working on for next upcoming semester is a thermal management program, which a huge part of the batteries operating properly is maintaining temperature. We're currently developing the program for that and how you service and operate it. We will have whole battery pack replacements, the braking systems, and then the regular odds and ends, interior components, maintenance.
How satisfying is this, being in this time, in this developing area?
Mike and myself, I have 25 years experience as a master technician. When I started out, cars just became front wheel drive and fuel injected. And everybody that was in the shop prior to me said, this front wheel drive fuel injection thing is going nowhere. And you know, it's full circle. I'm hearing the exact same thing from some of the negative people about electric vehicles. And it's exactly the same transition. The electric vehicles will be the future. It's an exciting new platform for all of us to learn on. It's going to be extreme less impact on the environment. It's going to create a much more renewable future for us, our families, and our kids, and our kids' kids.
Mike?
Having grown up in the community, I've been here my whole life, and what I would like to point out is when I went through Normal Community High School, I graduated in 1990. It was just a couple years after I graduated that they closed the auto shop, turned it into biology classrooms, and moved on. I crossed the street to Illinois State University. I actually went through their automotive program sort of backwards. I took all my major classes as a freshman and sophomore and university studies as a senior because, unbeknownst to me, they were, you know, limiting their automotive program. You know, they kept the manufacturing portion with the relationship with Mitsubishi. But as all those programs went away, it's just exciting to me that all these years later, now the resurgence, the need is being recognized, and you know, I can help promote and educate and bring that level of knowledge back and recreate where we were, I guess. So,
because this area is developing so rapidly, it's got to present a challenge to you to stay current in order to give the students the best and most current instruction. How do you do that?
Honestly, Mike and I are both very passionate about it. So our free time consists of research. I'm fortunately for myself, I work with Rivian, and I have access to a lot of all the information that Rivian possesses. So I get to share my knowledge with Mike. We talk about it, we bring it to the students. I'm able to see all the top level engineering and processes that are coming out every week, and along with research online, battery manufacturers, Mike and I just collaborate and we are able to bring it to the class.
Yeah, absolutely. This morning while I'm eating breakfast, I'm on the internet and I was researching the very brake booster and master cylinder combination that we took apart for the demonstration today. What I was actually looking for is, you know, how we can wire that without the computer so we can make it do its actions without the control system that, you know, eventually at some point we'd like to have in the lab. But right now, once again, it's some of it's proprietary, some of it's just that we don't have access to it yet. And being able to sort of hotwire that stuff to make it work to demonstrate to the students what terminal does what and what action does what, it's almost a hobby as well.
That's Mike Devers of Heartland Community College and Rivian trainer Tony Foose, who works with Heartland on the new electric vehicle energy storage training program. That effort is funded in part by the state's $15 million Manufacturing Training Academy's investment earlier this year. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Charles Bell is a professor and the author of a new book, but as a child growing up in Detroit, he couldn't picture himself surviving long enough to graduate high school. Bell says that's the experience of many kids who live with gun violence or other traumas. In his new book, Suspended, Punishment, Violence, and the Failure of School Safety, Bell says schools are punishing kids who are already suffering. In this conversation with Sarah Nardi, Bell says suspensions can be particularly devastating.
Even one suspension is harmful. I had students in my study who received one suspension and it happened to be on a day where they took an exam. So there's a 100-point test or a quiz on that day. So they may have had an A before the exam. They missed a 100-point exam and then they have an F or a D. So just one suspension is harmful. And then when we think about students who traditionally have received either 5-day suspensions, 10-day suspensions, or even multiple suspensions, we know that it's devastating for them because a lot of them, they can't catch up. And then they come back into the class off task after the suspension because they don't know what's happened. They've missed 5 days of school. And then they end up getting another suspension. So it's just a cumulative, catastrophic issue that we really need to talk about in our society.
It seems like a ripple effect. Certainly anyone who's missed school, I think, could probably, for whatever reason, relate to the feeling of being frustrated and disheartened when you come back and you really feel out of the loop. Can we talk a little bit about the idea behind suspensions in the first place? Because to hear you describe the effects of being suspended, it seems very counterintuitive.
So initially, the idea behind school suspension was to prevent students from coming to school with weapons, drug use. They were designed to prevent violence on school grounds. And what happened is that schools really took this zero tolerance framework that was implemented by the federal government in 1994 via the Gun-Free Schools Act. They took it too far and they expanded it to dress code, disrespect, and other minor infractions that were never designed to be punished as a out-of-school suspension. And what we're seeing is that in many cases, these schools, they don't even have like a first sort of step. Many schools don't have a detention or an in-school suspension option. They just go straight for the out-of-school suspension, which is the most harmful punishment in most cases. And I think the problem with our current understanding of school suspensions is that we assume that children who receive school suspensions are always bad or always disruptive. And that's just not the case. A lot of these students, their behaviors are being misinterpreted. And they are coming to school, they're navigating trauma on the way to school. No one knows, and no one's asking these kind of questions. What are you going through to get to school? What are you going through at home? What are you going through on the way home from school? It's really tough for a child to focus in school if they can't picture themselves being alive. You know, I remember growing up in a community where it was really difficult for me to picture myself going to high school and going to college because I was in the neighborhood where there were shootings all the time. So that's a sort of trauma. And children don't have an outlet to even talk about that sort of trauma in school or in their communities. So they end up internalizing it. And then their misbehavior is misconstrued as deviance or criminality, when in reality, it's a cry for help.
Do you think that that points to the need for more Black teachers in school or more teachers who are trained in trauma-informed response to really meet these kids where they are and instead of punishing them, recognize the cry for help for what it is and help?
I think that it's a cry for help from all educational stakeholders. I think that initially we've thought about just hiring more Black teachers, and I think that's important. But it places a small band-aid on a much larger situation because we're not addressing the teachers who have these implicit biases to begin with. I think that we have to have a conversation nationally amongst our education force about what we see when we look at Black children and the potential for them to be doctors and attorneys and whatever they want to be in society, and not just this sort of criminal deviance that we assign to Black children because their behaviors are being misinterpreted. I think it calls for a national discussion about the need for social workers and psychologists in schools nationally. And we have to question, why are social workers, psychologists, and counselors the first things we cut from schools when children need them the most? If we really want to produce an educated citizenry, we need to really start questioning why we are shifting so much money away from helping children and into criminalizing children, because there's always money for metal detectors and law enforcement officers and school resource officers.
And that ties into a larger conversation about how we allocate resources. Do you think that schools, you know, kind of fall back on suspensions to the degree that they do, in part because they're under-resourced and it's just easier to remove a child than to try to address what the issue is?
I think so as well. I think that's a sort of political violence that has been introduced into many urban school districts, where research shows that at most you should have 20 students in a class in most cases, when we know in urban areas there's upwards of 30, sometimes there's close to 40 students in a class. So I think this conversation for the most part about school suspension has been between the students and parents versus teachers, when in reality, it should be the students, teachers, and parents really talking to the policymakers who designed this system, where a teacher can't talk to a student because there's 40 students in their classroom. They can't give that individualized attention in many urban areas because there's so many different issues and there's such a lack of resources in the schools to begin with. And then they're continuously removing essential resources so that the teacher is using their own income to buy resources and things like that. So it's taxing for the teachers too. And I understand that they're in a difficult predicament in some cases. So I think that it's a conversation that needs to involve all sort of education stakeholders and criminal justice stakeholders. We need to be in a room together talking about this. We can't exclude students and parents. This is a conversation for everyone.
That was Charles Bell, an associate professor of criminal justice sciences at ISU. His new book is called Suspended: Punishment, Violence, and the Failure of School Safety. He spoke with Sarah Nardi. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. One of the oldest continuously operating organizations in Bloomington Normal is celebrating its sesquicentennial. The Masonic Lodge in Normal is 150 years old. Mike Tutter is the senior warden of the Lodge in Normal. That's the second in command behind the worshipful master. Tutter says though many things have changed about the organization over the last century and a half, the core values remain the same.
Years ago, the organization was thriving with members. You could go to lodge, you could go to activities, there'd be 30, 50, 100 people there. Today it's a little different, just like any organization. The Masons or the Masonic organization is struggling with membership a little bit. In general, though, the principles and what we believe in and what we try and do has never changed. Our slogan, of course, is make men better than they are. That was one of the things that lured me to it as well.
So how does the organization go about doing that, living that out?
We always want to make sure that we put our families first no matter what. After that, we want to make sure that we continue to strive to push ourselves. We want to better ourselves inside as a person, our morals, our standards. Masonry has done that for me a lot. We are still a community-based organization. We still do our charitable funds. We go out into the public. A couple of years we've been at the Worldwide Day of Play. The Illinois Grand Lodge has a child identification program that's free that we put on. Parents can come in. They go through all the steps to receive a packet of information about their child and so forth. We help at the community food banks and so forth as well. So the community part of that, we're still in it greatly.
Masons, Elks, Eagles, you name the social group, they're all struggling for membership. How has society changed in a way that no longer makes these the community center that they once were?
Technology is a huge one. In the past, you wanted to see someone, you walked or drove to their home, or you met somewhere. You had to pick up the phone and talk. Nowadays, there are so many activities and so much going on with technology now, you don't even need to leave the couch to talk to someone anymore. So why put forth at times an effort to get out there in the community, into an organization, to work with others in the community or help that community out, when all you got to do is sit on the phone? Well, in one or two clicks, you can send somebody money now as well. It's not something you have to go to a charity event for or anything. So technology has been a big one there. And then as these organizations try and or start to fade off a little bit, or I guess disappear in some instances, they're no longer in the eye of the public or they're no longer around. So yeah, it is a struggle at times to try and
How has this chapter of the Masons tried to reinvent itself and stay vital and relevant?
One of the big things you've got to look at is how do you get younger folks in? A lot of Masonic lodges nowadays are struggling because, not necessarily financially, but the membership is getting older and they're passing away, and they're not replacing those men with newer members fast enough. Normal Lodge has tapped into some of our younger members, maybe out of college or who was in college, tapped into the fraternities, tapped into other groups that might be interested. I do know, like at Wesleyan University down here, they have an Acacia Lodge, which is a fraternity, but it is a fraternity just kind of built around what Masons are. So we do draw in guys like that as well.
Every group has a way to make its members bind and tie together. You know, teachers and lawyers have a specialty language that they share. Social groups tend to have ritual and ceremony to perform that function. Do the Masons still have those kinds of things, or are those viewed as kind of quaint?
No, we still have our what I call the basics from many, many years ago. Yes, we do have ritual. We do have ceremonies. Your initiation into the Masonic Lodge has three steps, of course, that you must take. That is done in ritual and ceremony as well.
Are those comforts to you? What appeals?
For myself, it was after I took the initial step to become a Mason, that first degree, so is what it's called. There's a first, second, and third degree. After taking that first degree, walking in, not knowing anything, for me was, I know there's something else there. There's more to this organization. And I was welcomed by Normal Lodge with open arms. I don't know, just that core fabric there. Once I walked in, once I talked to the brethren.
So the ceremony helps you center.
It did, yes.
That's Mike Tutter, the senior warden of the Masonic Lodge in Normal. The lodge has been in several locations over the decades, but from 1926 to about 11 years ago, it was in what is now Uptown Normal. The town did a land swap to facilitate part of the Uptown Revitalization Project, and a bank now sits on the land. The new lodge is on the grounds of the old Illinois Soldiers and Sailors Children's Home in Normal. The anniversary observance will be a public ceremony and rededication of the building Saturday at 1 p.m. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.